Hello, welcome to the Patient Activation Network podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cavallo. I have with me today Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter. Shoshana is a practicing physician in the Bay Area, and she's also the founder of the Endwell Symposium. Shoshana, welcome to the podcast.
Matt, thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for being here. Before we get started, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I am an internal medicine physician. I practice in a hospital setting at a teaching institution in San Francisco. And then in my non-clinical time, I run a philanthropic fund, the Ungerleiter Fund, which supports innovation in palliative care education, part of which the Endwell Symposium is a part of.
And that is such an interesting topic. And, you know, just a little bit more about your background. So when you graduate college and you get out there in the field, what was it about you that gravitated towards palliative care?
Well, it's funny. I took a bit of a non-traditional route to medicine. I think that's actually pretty common these days. I finished college and thought I was actually going to do a doctorate in marine science. And after spending a few months living on the Oregon coast at a marine lab, I realized that I really wanted to work with people, that maybe medicine, although I wasn't pre-med in college, would be a route for me. And so I took a big risk and I moved all the way across the country to a place I'd never even been before. I didn't know a soul, and took a short-term job, a summer job at the medical center at Duke University. And it was through a series of experiences and really fantastic mentors there that led me to a place where I was thinking that medicine was going to be the path for me. And I found myself back in college doing undergrad courses at UNC Chapel Hill. And fast forward a few years, and I was enrolled in medical school in Portland, Oregon, at Oregon Health and Science University. And I, you know, I'd had a few years of experience in clinical medicine leading up to medical school, as many people do, and doing some research that I loved. And one thing, you know, that throughout my medical school years, looking back, I now realize is that doctors are not taught sort of how we can be of service, to be of use for people for whom, you know, a cure is not an option, right? We're taught that death is the ultimate failure, and that our job as doctors is really just to cure people, and that's it. There's no place for us if somebody isn't able to be cured of their illness. And so I entered residency training, and with that, you know, idea, I had come across one time a palliative care physician during medical school. I sort of looked at the name on his white coat, and I said, well, what is palliative care? You know, what? And then when I learned, it just made no sense to me why a doctor who was trained to save lives would ever be focused on serious illness or hospice or the end of life experience. And then I found myself early in my residency, my intern year, spending several months in the ICU setting. So the place where patients receive the most aggressive care, a place where we save lives every day. We're so technologically advanced now in 2017 such that, you know, we can keep people alive, and we do save many, many lives, and it's fantastic. What I realized though was that I was seeing very large numbers of elderly, very frail adults that had, you know, many chronic medical conditions. And then on top of that, something like widely metastatic cancer or end-stage heart failure was bringing them into the hospital, and they were getting admitted to the ICU despite the fact that nothing that we were going to do for them was actually going to reverse their underlying problem. And I realized that I was involved in prolonging their suffering, right? And keeping them from maybe their loved ones or their home in their last days or weeks of life. And so it didn't sit well with me. I was pretty distressed about it. And looking back on that experience, I mean, I know that isn't just my hospital in San Francisco where this happens. This is actually going on all over the country. And I've come to recognize this as truly a public health crisis, that people aren't dying in the ways that match the goals and values of how they really want to live their lives. And I think there's many reasons for this, which I'm happy to go into, but it's something that I have set out to really change.
It's such a tough conversation to have, and I just really have a lot of respect for what you're doing. Was there kind of this defining moment where you said, I really want to improve end-of-life medicine or palliative care?
Yeah, I think there were a few defining moments. And interestingly, again, you know, they happened for me in the ICU, taking care of the sickest patients who in these cases happened to be also much older adults who were very, very frail. Again, for whom, you know, the aggressive, invasive measures that we were going to weren't going to help them and were actually physically hurting them. You know, I can give you, you know, many, many examples of patients who are in their 80s or 90s for whom they've been sick for years and years. And, you know, their metastatic cancer actually was to a point where they couldn't breathe any longer and they were physically unable to get out of bed. And I would meet them for the very first time in the morning, walking in at 5 a.m. to the ICU, and they had come in overnight short of breath and really, you know, in a dire situation. And unfortunately for many of these people, you know, the conversations about prognosis, about weren't taking place early on, maybe at the time of diagnosis or once the chemotherapy or radiation was no longer effective. And so they end up really by default receiving this aggressive invasive care. And what I mean by that is, you know, putting a windpipe into their mouth and hooking them up to a machine to breathe for them, or inserting, you know, large IVs into their neck and into their legs in order to pump them full of medicines to keep their blood pressure up because they're trying to die. And this happens all the time. And it's not to say that, again, we save lives every day in the ICU. So I'm definitely a proponent of medical care, but only when it's when people are fully informed about the decisions that they're making, and not by default that somebody would end up in a situation like this, especially if they're older, especially if they're very, very ill and frail. I think I realized that conversations weren't taking place along the way in the journeys of these people, you know, 20 years upstream from a situation like this, or even a few years at the time when they're diagnosed with a serious illness. Doctors really shy away from these conversations, I think, for many reasons. We don't want patients to think we're giving up on them. We don't know how to broach this topic. We want patients to like us. But what I learned is, you know, when I can be open and honest with people, they actually, for the most part, really appreciate it. I treat my patients like I would treat my family members and say, hey, listen, here's what I'm concerned about. Here's what I think the future may hold for you. How can we come up with a plan together that fits, you know, your goals and what's most meaningful to you in your life?
You brought up such a great point about the timing of the conversations. How are doctors trained to have these conversations today?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it turns out that most doctors aren't trained in a formal way to have these conversations. The latest data out of the Journal of the American Medical Association from last year showed that 70% of doctors report that they're not comfortable having difficult conversations with patients about prognosis, about discussing life-limiting illness or goals of care. So while Medicare now reimburses doctors for having conversations around advanced care planning, I believe we've really put the cart before the horse, given that most doctors out there don't even know how to talk about this. One thing that I recognized, you know, when I finished training was that our program here in San Francisco could really benefit from training all of our residents, all of our doctors in training about how to communicate effectively with patients. So I feel strongly that no matter what field of medicine people end up in, whether it's a hospital-based doctor like me, a primary care doctor, a neurologist, a cardiologist, that it's all of our responsibilities to sit down and talk with patients about these issues, depending on, you know, what that patient is facing. I mean, oftentimes people will see their oncologist or their cardiologist, their heart doctor, much more often than they'll see their family doctor. And, you know, at the time of a serious diagnosis, it's really the right thing to do and the best practice of medicine to be open and honest about prognosis and talk about goals of care. And what I mean by that is thinking about an advanced directive. And I would actually make the argument that the earlier people can start discussing issues related to advanced care planning, the better. I know for myself, you know, when I got married, so in my 30s, I sat down with my husband and talked about, you know, what I would want if I were to become sick or not able to speak for myself, because we don't always know. We hope that there's, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 more years ahead of us, but in reality, there's no way to know, right? And so the earlier we can be engaging in conversations with our loved ones, the more we'll make sure that, again, that we have some control over, you know, how we're cared for and whatever that means. And for some people, that's, you know, full care, aggressive, invasive measures in the ICU. And for others, it's the opposite. It depends on what people, you know, value most. And I don't think these conversations have to be dark and upsetting. I mean, it's always a challenge to broach this topic. But I actually think that bringing these issues up around the dinner table or at a family like holiday gathering can be really powerful and can allow us to connect more deeply with our loved ones by asking the questions of, well, what's most meaningful to you, you know, in your life? Or, you know, what do you want to be remembered for in your life? Which I think can only bring families closer together. And I'll also say, you know, legal documents, advanced directives are a good first step in this process, but they're not enough. It turns out that even if you have an advanced directive, it may not be followed. If people can't find it, if it's locked away somewhere, if you're taken to a hospital that's never seen you before and doesn't have your information on file, or if there's disagreement among family members about what you would want if you're not able to speak for yourself, that creates huge problems. So the more that we can actually have clear, open dialogue with our loved ones about our wishes, the better. And there are some fantastic platforms out there. One of them that comes to mind is a website called Death Over Dinner, deathoverdinner.org. And that uses a pretty templated facilitation guide for people to host dinners and invite friends or colleagues or family members over for dinner and to talk about various topics related to mortality. There's also a fantastic card game that you can actually play with children called Go Wish. And it really is focused on, you know, what matters most to people in their lives in various stages of life and can really help to dive more deeply into a conversation related to goals in the advanced care planning realm. Another kind of more innovative company is Life Folder, which I will disclose I am advising as a startup, is using an AI chatbot via Facebook Messenger to engage younger people in a conversation around advanced care planning. So it's a very different than the traditional, you know, pen and paper model, which I love. Because again, I think that the earlier we can start engaging in these conversations, the better. And finally, I'll add, I think that people need to revisit this topic at various stages in their lives, because what we may want when we're healthy at 30 is different than what we would want at maybe 50 or 70 or 90. Because our health conditions change and our ideas about life change over time.
How did you, in your 30s, turn to your husband and engage him in that discussion? What are some strategies that maybe if I wanted to sit down with one of my loved ones and say, hey, you know, I'm thinking about this. I know it's not on my radar and hopefully not for many years down the road, but I want to start talking to you about my intentions. What would your advice be, or some strategies be, for having those difficult conversations?
Well, I'll say we're a little weird in my household. We actually love talking about death. We feel like it kind of reminds us that each day is a gift and that, you know, living and dying aren't separate things. As my friend Lucy Kalanathi, whose late husband wrote When Breath Becomes Air, she says, you know, living and dying aren't separate things. We're doing both at the same time. And I feel strongly that You know, if we can recognize that life ends, it makes our time that much more kind of rich and meaningful. So I think you know, both my husband and I come at a conversation, you know, with that overarching idea. But I think there are, you know, some wonderful, I mean, it honestly depends on, you know, people's personality. Some folks enter this information funnel or this emotional, people enter this conversation for different reasons. Sometimes it's because they've been diagnosed with an illness, or it's because they have an aging parent for whom they need to be starting to think about this. For others, it's more of like a logistical, like financial discussion of, gosh, where do I want, you know, my assets to go if I'm not here any longer? And I think for others, it's more around children. You know, I think a beautiful, wonderful time to have this conversation is it, you know, after the birth of your first child, or obviously if you decide to have children. I think that people come at this with a new understanding of the fact that when you're responsible for a new human being, your child, that you have to start thinking beyond just, you know, maybe the short term and long term, who might care for that child if something were to happen to you. I don't think there's one way to engage in this particular conversation, but I think, you know, if you really come at it with the intention that I want to get to know my partner or get to know my mother or father or brother or sister better by asking some of these questions, I think it can be really, really powerful. And as I said, it only brings people closer together.
We're with Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, and we're talking about palliative care strategies, end-of-life planning. And she has shared with us some great resources that are going to be available in the podcast notes. So please go and read the podcast notes if you want to look up any of the great resources that she shared. I want to switch gears just a little bit here, because you're taking your passion for end-of-life planning and you've turned it into a learning opportunity with the Endwell Symposium. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So it was always my dream to have a national or an international convening of people who care about this topic, about changing this conversation around end-of-life. And I attend many palliative care, healthcare-focused conferences and policy-focused convenings throughout the year. And there is a fantastic group of individuals from different professional backgrounds that come together and are very motivated and, you know, thoughtful about making change in this area. But one thing I realized over the years is that the same people, you know, coming together often and working together. And I actually feel that we should open up this conversation to a more interdisciplinary mix. I think that this is not just a healthcare problem, not just a policy issue. This is a human issue, and it's the way we care for people throughout the continuum of their life, especially at the end of life, is something that we should all be involved in. So I founded Endwell with a team from California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, and it's really the first of its kind gathering to bring together the world of design, of technology, of healthcare, of policy, of patient advocacy, the arts, education, and even media, with the goal of generating interprofessional, human-centered innovation for the end-of-life experience. And we have We have 400 attendees coming in from all over the world, from different backgrounds, all coming together to discuss really what it means to live well until the very end. And we have 25 incredible speakers lined up who are all thought leaders from their fields, who will be delivering engaging, fast-paced talks throughout the day with art and music woven in. And it's taking place on December 7th of this year in San Francisco. And we welcome designers, we welcome entrepreneurs, patients, obviously healthcare providers, anyone who's a caregiver, someone from policy or journalism who who really, you know, want to engage with this important movement. And we hope to just continue to capitalize on the momentum that's already building in this space. So there's more information at endwellproject.org.
You really struck a chord with me when you said that this was a human problem. And one of the things that I've been so impressed about the Endwell Symposium is, like you say, it's not only multidisciplinary from a clinical perspective, but in my mind, it's really innovative from a healthcare conference standpoint in that you're inviting people, speakers with such a broad perspective. Whether they be artists or musicians or doctors, what was it that attracted you to speakers from such diverse backgrounds?
Well, I'll say we are explicitly not a healthcare conference. I think we're trying to do our very best to make sure that people recognize that this is something very different than what's been done before, and we're welcoming, you know, of anyone and everyone who care about this topic. For me, you know, as I said, I think we really need to get outside of our traditional spheres of influence. For me, that's healthcare. To really make change in this space, we need to bring new, diverse perspectives to the conversation. I think we're often very siloed, you know, in our own networks or our own professions. And I want to stress that this is something that's important for all human beings, because we'll all be patients, right, at some point if we haven't already been. So we all have a stake in this movement. And, you know, I feel strongly that this is not just about, you know, doctors and healthcare administrators and nurses and social workers. This is, we are a part of that conversation, but it's much broader than just us.
So the Endwell Symposium sounds really great. If I wanted to attend, how would I go about doing that?
Well, you'd go to our website, which is www.endwellproject.org, and click register. I will tell you, we've had a fantastic, really overwhelming response from people from all over the world wanting to attend, and we are very close to selling out. So if you're interested in joining us in San Francisco on December 7th, be sure to reserve your spot very soon.
Well, and if you do sell out, or, you know, if I'm unable to attend in person, how could I follow this symposium online?
Yes. So for people who can't be there in person, there are many ways to follow us. I would say definitely head over to the website, endwellproject.org, and sign up for updates. We'll be releasing our full speaker lineup as well as future programs via email throughout the year. And then we'll be also videotaping many of our talks and releasing that content throughout the year as well. And so if you're signed up on the email list, you'll be sure to get those. And then, of course, follow us on social media. We are active on Twitter at EndwellSF, as well as Facebook at Endwell Project, and on LinkedIn, you can find us as well.
And for our listeners that want to learn more, we'll make sure that we have all these links in the podcast notes. Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast today. We really appreciate what you do.
Oh, Matt, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all for tuning in to the Patient Activation Network podcast. We'll bring you another inspirational story soon.